Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Moitha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. Vasuki Nesaya is Professor of Practice at NYU Gallatin, where she teaches human rights and legal and social theory. She's a founding member of Third World Approaches to International Law, also known as TWAIL. She has published widely on issues of history and politics of human rights, humanitarianism, international criminal law, reparations, global feminism, and decolonization. Her forthcoming books include International Conflict Feminism, forthcoming with the University of Pennsylvania Press, and Reading the Ruins, Colonialism, Slavery, and International Law. On the 26th of October 2023, Vasuki gave the London Review of International Law annual lecture at the LSE on the topic of genocide. This was, of course, a short time after the horrific terrorist attacks that Hamas carried out on the 7th of October in Israel and the as yet unrelenting war on Palestinians that Israel is carrying out in Gaza. Genocide is the apex crime in international law, and its application tends to be tightly controlled by lawyers, and also its extension to various international crimes or state crimes often resisted by various states, usually the perpetrators. One needs to only think of the Armenian genocide, which I discussed on this podcast with Mark Nishanian, author of the extraordinary book, The Historiographical Perversion. Vasuki eschews the view that genocide is the exceptional crime and pulls it back into the ordinary. She does this by explaining how Eurocentric racism is baked into the application of the concept of genocide. Rather than treating genocide as a spatio-temporally confined event, it is understood as a structural process of world-making whereby settler colonial practices of dispossession, expulsion, and various governance practices can inform how we identify genocides. This process-focused approach can then start to inform how we understand the problem of justice in response to mass violence. Vasuki and I discuss her research into the German genocide of the Herero and Nama in what was German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, in the very early part of the 20th century. The genocide of the Nama and Herero is often obscenely referred to as the rehearsal for the Holocaust. What are the implications of the claim that a genocide is rehearsed? The German state recently acknowledged its genocide of the Herero and Nama, but refused to call the payments that are being made to Namibia reparations, and rather called it international development aid. Why is this? What is the scope and threat of reparations? What would it mean to keep the process of justice open rather than to close it in the manner that Germany has attempted to do in relation to Namibia? In our discussion, we draw on these questions, examples, and analysis to consider their implications for Israel, Palestine, and what is unfolding there as we speak. We consider the creation of settlements, reservations, the continuities of the notion of the domestic dependent nation that has implications for what people refer to as the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine. Vasuki queries the redemptive narrative of international law, which charts a linear development from Nuremberg to the International Criminal Court in The Hague and ask, for whom is this international law? Is it for the victims of violence or is it for international lawyers? Vasuki Nesaya, welcome to Countersign and thank you for joining me. At the end of October, you gave the London Review of International Law annual lecture. That concerned the topic of genocide. The lecture was being given just 2 weeks after the horrific attacks by Hamas in Israel and Israel's all-out war on Gaza, which has resulted in a horrendous loss of life. So talk of genocide being committed in occupied Gaza is proliferating among critics of Israel. One of the more prominent voices in this regard was Craig Mockheber, the former director of the New York office of the UN High Commission for Human Rights, who on the 28th of October stated, to quote here, "Once again, we're seeing a genocide unfolding before our eyes, and the organization we serve, that is the UN, appears to be powerless to stop it," end of quote. Now, this statement connects with a number of themes in your lecture and in your wider research. One aspect of it is that international lawyers tend to revel in a good crisis, as you've said in a previous published piece, quoting Hilary Charlesworth, who made these comments in relation to the Kosovo crisis. There's a sense in which international law is a discipline that seems to develop in the context of crises such as this. And there's also a call by lay people to international lawyers to say something or do something. And so the effectiveness of international law, the very crisis of whether international law is law, presents itself in situations like this. On the other hand, your work points to the fact that we should stop treating genocide as an event and focus much more on the manner in which these kinds of crimes evidence a structural process of world-making. So that's an important part of your argument. But let's begin with the context in which we're speaking, that is the violence unfolding in Palestine.
Thanks, Stuart. Yeah, no, it seems like a inflection point on many different counts, including, of course, conditions on the ground in Palestine. And of course, there's a lot of genocide talk. And I think, you know, genocide, you know, I suppose as lawyers, we often interpret it past the sort of international law technicalities, or is it genocide, or what are the elements of a crime, or does it qualify? But of course, most of the time when people are using the term genocide, and perhaps even people like Craig Mockheber are using genocide not only as a legal claim, although maybe also that, but perhaps even primarily as a way to express protest, as a way to express grief, to channel anger, to speak of either equality of all lives. So international law doesn't have a monopoly on the term genocide, that it has sort of this wider purchase, which of course shapes the legal meanings of genocide and the way and is part of the landscape against which law unfolds and gets interpolated in different kinds of ways. So I just want to say that firstly, that, you know, that genocide, of course, has all these other implications. But certainly the fact that genocide has, you know, sometimes is even in law is treated as the apex crime, and certainly some legal scholars speak of it as such, it puts pressure on interpreting all horrors as genocide, and in fact may neglect or even license other crimes because they don't fall within the technical meanings of genocide or how the dominant sort of legal punditry defined genocide in some sense. So extraordinarily, even for instance, the colonization of Palestine or the occupation of Palestine may appear in some framings as a lesser crime than genocide, because genocide is seen as this sort of extraordinary event that, you know, defined by the Holocaust as its primary reference, and nothing else quite matches. And I guess my own intervention there is to actually pull genocide back into the ordinary, not because it's less horrific, but because the horrors seem routine rather than exceptional, that mm-hmm. it's rather than a violation of the law, it's often the rules of the game.
Yes. So I think that's an important place from which we can move to the history of the concept of genocide and indeed how racist logics are baked into the concept. So often people, particularly in the current moment, as you say, will look at the Genocide Convention and the extremely narrow definition, including the requirement for there to be an intent to eliminate or partly eliminate and exterminate a people, nation, religion, etc. But this narrow definition also, in a sense, conceals the manner in which, as you say, the Holocaust of European Jews is treated as the yardstick, the manner in which there's a certain Eurocentric racism in identifying the victims who tend to be European and the non-Europeans tend to be perpetrators. So one aspect of this is that there's a certain slow violence that I think you referred to in your lecture as well, a term expanded on by Rob Nixon's terrific work. That tends to be ignored in this kind of spectacularizing of the crime and the focus on the crime itself. But in your lecture, you very usefully took us to the example of the Herero and Nama peoples, the first genocide of the 20th century, if you like, committed by Germany in what was then Southwest Africa and currently Namibia. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, sure. So in fact, I came to, I guess, thinking about this topic for the Lang lecture in relation to Namibia. And then just the timing was such that events in Palestine emerged as sort of as a backdrop through which I was thinking through these things. Yes, yeah, so in Namibia, you know, perhaps more people know about it now than a few years back because there's been so much mobilization around it. But still, it remains quite obscure, despite being, as you say, often spoken of as the first genocide of the 20th century, where in German colonization essentially worked both just like settler in ways that are similar or familiar from settler colonialism in other contexts, where there was a process of dispossession of indigenous people of their land, a process of accumulation of colonial capital through that dispossession. But it was a process that was both a military process, a legal process. It had many different dimensions to it. And often when people speak about Herero and Nama communities and the genocide against them, they speak about the extermination orders that the German officer, Colonel Van Trotha, issued in 1904 against the Herero, for instance. But in fact, by 1902, 2 years before the extermination orders, only 40% of what is Namibia today was still owned by Africans. So there's a way in which I think of genocide as also already being happening. It's something, the extermination orders is one particular symptom of the genocide or one particular expression of it. But the process of land dispossession took place both violently and legally in many different sort of theaters. And certainly in the Namibian case, was part of what enabled the extermination orders. It was that whole process was a creation of a certain legitimizing of German rule and German military authority. And that was, it's, I think, inextricable from the extermination orders themselves. So the extermination orders may have catalyzed the fastest mode of sort of killing the Herero in a very short period, but it wasn't by any means something that came out of nowhere, as it were.
Absolutely. And so this takes us to how modes of settler colonialism and property law, the Lockean theory, operates. And this is a process, you describe it in relation to the Germans in Southwest Africa, but also a process that we've seen in Palestine through a Zionist process of settler colonialism, the Nakba, the expulsion and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the process of the creation of the State of Israel and so on. So are these two processes that you want to emphasize, the longer process rather than the precise event of a particular act of violence?
Yes, both in terms of thinking about event versus structure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Patrick Wolfe was a historian and theorist of settler colonialism and of indigenous studies, has always this argument about settler colonialism being not event but process. And so, you know, that seems a compelling and useful way of thinking about it. But also that I think the other reason for me in terms of framing the longer history of genocidal governance in some sense is a material dimension of racial oppression. Treating race as somehow abstracted from the appropriation of land in the settler colonial context seems to somehow miss a crucial dimension of what exactly is the logic of settler colonialism. And that this focus on extermination alone disconnects destruction from dispossession and becomes part of the way in which we don't attend to the sort of the political economy, as it were, of genocide. And that's true, you know, even of certainly of the United States, this very famous case onwards, Johnson versus McIntosh, that enabled the dispossession or legalized the dispossession of indigenous communities in the United States to a whole range of other contexts from Palestine to Kenya, where there has been the appropriation of land, or Australia, you know, a whole range of contexts where the dispossession and extermination are really intertwined processes.
Yes, I think this is a really important point that you make in your lecture as well, which is that, you know, we often read about a colonial encounter as involving a doctrine of terra nullius, the sense that there is a vacant land. And of course, as we know from a number of cases, international law, especially the Western Sahara case, that it was peopled territories that were treated as terra nullius, so not actually vacant land. But I think the point you made really well in your lecture was the manner in which in processes of genocide, the goal is the creation of a terra nullius.
Right.
The goal is the vacating of peoples from land in order to produce the settler colonial nation. And that is the key process that tends to be ignored when it is the event of extermination itself that becomes the focus of international law and genocide.
Right, right. So it also, you know, it speaks to two things. One is that international law is part of the problem, not just the solution. Mm-hmm. So when we look for international law as and the Convention on Genocide, we think of international law as somehow standing outside or above the problem and then coming in afterwards to sort it out or to produce a taxonomy of crimes and define who is a perpetrator and who is a victim or the terms through which we adjudicate that. But in fact, you know, a concept like terra nullius that's internal to international law or the rights of the doctrine of discovery, that these become in fact part of the tools of genocide rather than something that's coming in afterwards from outside of a genocidal process. So that's one thing about thinking about international law's own complicities and then how we understand that and how we mobilize international law in that context. And perhaps the other thing I would like to say is that, you know, genocide, often the way we speak about genocide and perhaps even the way Lemkin defines genocide, it treats group membership as somehow the groups that are potentially vulnerable to genocide as defined, as something that's been set in advance. While in fact, often genocidal processes are in fact creating what we now think of as racial communities or religious communities, ethnic communities, that it is in fact the violence that produces that. So in terms of distinguishing what is whiteness or what is Africanness or what is Germanness or what is Americanness or who is Cherokee and who is not or who is Palestinian and who is Jewish. These are processes that are intertwined with genocidal processes, the process of race making, of identity formation. It's not the only thing that's responsible for those kinds of things, but it's also, you know, social if we think of identities as socially constructed, this is certainly law and violence and governance are part of identity construction. You know, like with Terranilia, so a parallel to that in some sense, we often confuse the consequence from a pre-existing structure that then that's awaiting either genocidal or non-genocidal violence, while in fact these are also sort of co-producive or co-constitutive in some important way.
Mm-hmm. A little while ago, you referred to the very important U.S. Supreme Court case of Johnson versus McIntosh, a famous judgment of Chief Justice Marshall, who in 1823 articulated that native people could not alienate land and thereby set the narrative of sovereignty derived from the colonizer to the successor, the United States. The case, which articulated the so-called doctrine of discovery enabled what was effectively a conquest that was underway and in parts of the United States hadn't yet occurred, to be turned into a doctrine by which property rights could be created and thus also transferred by the sovereign. And an important part of Johnson versus McIntosh was the fact that Chief Justice Marshall has to struggle with the fact that Indigenous Americans have natural rights in land, because natural rights was a philosophy that was used by the American revolutionaries against the British. So in terms of being intellectually consistent, Marshall had to struggle with the fact of Indigenous peoples having these natural rights. But then he had to explain and justify not respecting those rights. And the way he did that was to say that they were uncivilized, that they were basically so barbarian that you couldn't commune with them, you couldn't interact, that civilized peoples could not interact with them. So that is the manner in which the race is baked into a concept of genocide and the practices of genocide over time. Now, one of the really influential arguments that I think both you and I have engaged with is Mahmoud Mamdani's important work. There's many books, of course, but importantly pertinent to this conversation is his 2020 book, Neither Settler Nor Native, The Making and Unmaking of Permanent Minorities. And one of his arguments is that the process of nation building that was charted by the United States, which involved the creation of a certain nation and a national identity, which excluded the indigenous population, that turned them into a domestic dependent nation, as was articulated again by Marshall in the 1830s in Cherokee Nation versus the State of Georgia, that this process is one that is mimicked in later colonial encounters. Now, the Germans in Southwest Africa is one example. What takes place in Europe during the Second World War, whereby European Jews are expelled, exterminated and expelled, is another example. There's, of course, Sudan, and very importantly for Mamdani, the other example of this nation-building process and the creation of certain majorities and minorities is Palestine and Israel. So I wanted you to maybe engage with how you draw on that argument and perhaps to amplify it with reference to the experiences in Southwest Africa and Namibia.
Right. Yeah, no, I think there's something really significant there about how the nation state, which is, of course, the critical building block in some sense of international law's approach to thinking about political society, is itself something that has within it this majoritarian logic that then we see providing being the precondition for various kinds of anti-minoritarian violence that in some contexts we may call genocidal. That's important. And I think it's important to both think of that in terms of who benefits and who loses from that turn to the nation state as the framing category. What are its implications? and the ironies of that we think of even that historically, certainly, that even Palestinian self-determination was conceived of in terms of an aspiration to a nation state. In the Southwest African context, you see a particular kinds of tension, because now in negotiation around reparations for the genocide, you see the Herero and the Nama community, indigenous communities within Namibia, in some sense with numbers hugely reduced precisely because of the genocide, then being sort of marginal to the process of negotiation of reparations with the German state, which the Ovambo and the majority community has negotiated as sole representatives, and the Namibian government as sole representatives of the peoples within its territories has negotiated what it means to come to terms with the history of colonialism in ways that actually then build on the logic of number, which, you know, many others, David Scott and many others, have also spoken of as being sort of inherent to a majoritarian nationalism or majoritarian nation state, emerges even through as part of the tragedy in some sense of post-colonial nationhood, and then gets replicated. So the way in which the Herero and Nama can get recognition for genocide, the way it's the framing produces it as sort of an inevitable conflict with the Namibian nation state, which is the state that has emerged after the anti-colonial struggles. Those kinds of sort of toxic tensions are built into a system that depends on the nation state to be there. To be the only political voice that's recognized in the international public sphere.
Mm-hmm. That's also your mention of reparations there reminded me of another very important point that you make in the lecture and in other writings, in the manner in which the focus on reparations is another eventual aspect of thinking about genocide, isn't it? Because it then that you think less about structure and process, and much more about the specific violence and who are the descendant communities and who might be able to draw on reparations. And importantly, in the case of Namibia, the German state has recognized that this was a genocide, and it has apologized, but it has not referred to the payments that are to be made to Namibia as reparations. It has framed it in terms of international aid. I wondered if you wanted to just discuss that aspect a bit more.
Sure. And precisely, it wants to refer to it as development aid precisely because it wants to see it as a way to close the books. Mm-hmm. And if we think of genocide as something that is a process and not an event, then presumably reparations for colonialism will also have to be a process. And it's something that opens the books rather than closes it, mm-hmm. and makes it an ongoing process. It's part of the human rights law approach to reparations historically has treated reparations as a way to make amends. And although there's often some invocation about of the notion that you can never completely repay particular kinds of damages, in fact, it's supposed to be the end of the conversation. And there's always the idea that after reparations, then there's a new dawn. While in fact, if we think of it as somehow structural and we think of the impact of genocide as being as deep as we think it is, then it's not something that can just be closed. You know, so it's how we think about reparations. It's how we think about justice. You know, I'm reminded also in this context of sort of Hannah Arendt speaking about Eichmann, where, you know, her critique in some sense of the trial was that it treated Eichmann also as an event, as, you know, this monstrous man produced, and his sort of toxic anti-Semitism was part of the story of the Holocaust. And to have justice, you need to prosecute him. While her argument, of course, was what was most extraordinary about Eichmann was precisely his ordinariness. It was the banality of evil, that in fact the process, therefore, of coming to terms with what enabled the Holocaust is going to be an extended process. It's not going to be something that can be resolved in the context of a court case. In fact, that is to minimize the horrors of the Holocaust, to think that finding Eichmann guilty is somehow a form of justice that is equal to the crimes that we associate with the Holocaust. And so I think, you know, the reparations conversation is very similar in some sense, that it doesn't mean that you don't need to do things to ameliorate the lives of people in the short term, but we have to think of those as sort of a short-term processes, and there are ongoing long-term processes. Colonialism took place over many hundreds of years. Coming to terms with that will also take many hundreds of years. This is not something which we can bound and delimit as something that's in the past.
Yeah, that's a really crucial question about justice, particularly the context in which reparation is posed. And in fact, it's an argument in relation to Germany and the Holocaust of European Jews. It's a point that Mamdani makes about his critique of the Nuremberg process, that you know, the Nuremberg trials turned the genocide into a crime and processed it, as it were, as a crime. And of course, what that left in place was the basis of a Nazi ideology. So denazification became sort of focused on trying particular individuals at Nuremberg rather than addressing a history of anti-Semitism and the production of a certain kind of Volk in Germany, and what it would mean for Europe to be a more tolerant society for its minorities. So I think that's a really important point to hold on to. The other aspect of justice is what it means to keep the process open, as it were. Again, to return to Palestine and the current moment, one of the things we keep hearing about is the need for progress on a two-state solution. But the kind of Palestinian state that even the neighbors of Palestine, such as Egypt, have in mind is a completely deracinated state as we would usually understand a state. So, for example, recently Egypt made the point that the state of Palestine or a state of Palestine would be a demilitarized state. And in a sense, what's being imagined is a little bit like the Cherokee Nation in the 19th century. That is to say, almost a domestic dependent nation, one that doesn't have the usual powers and accoutrements of a state. Really, we're talking here about the production of majorities and minorities once again, and the extremely vexed question of the nature of the state of Israel as a Jewish state and not a secular democratic state. So that has minorities, but minorities who are treated as equal citizens. And it's that horizon and that just horizon that is lost when we speak of a two-state solution.
Yeah, true. And I think one element of in some sense, it's an American export, this idea of reservations that then have mutated and become, had carried very different kinds of forms in different places. Arguably, certainly was invoked in South Africa in apartheid South Africa, and how group reservation policy was undertaken and implemented, that it borrowed very heavily from the mode of reservations in settler colonialism in the US. And arguably what's being proposed for Palestine is also a form of reservation. It's some of that same structure, as people would argue that what's the situation in the West Bank today is already a form of reservation, and that's what's being proposed for Palestine is also that kind of shape. So to think of it as being in the family of states in the same way of Israel as a state is very different. Yeah, a different kind of creature, a sub-state creature that is in fact something that is that helps constitute what the state is. And this may go back to Mamdani in terms of the ways in which the state structure has within its DNA particular kinds of notions.
So Vasuki, one of the literary texts that you draw on in your lecture is Jackie Sibley's Drury's play, We Are Proud to Present a Presentation. Part of what the play does is in fact present the genocide of Dinama and Herero, but also do so through the concept of rehearsal, because the genocide of Herero and Nama is treated by some people and in some discourses as a sort of rehearsal for the Holocaust during the Second World War. Now, part of what Drury does in this amazing play is interrogate the concept of rehearsal itself. And you make use of that in your thinking. So perhaps you could expand on that.
Yes, sure. I mean, I find the play really productive to think with on a range of different kinds of grounds. I mean, on the one hand, yes, as you said, the whole play is structured as a rehearsal. And it is, in that sense, a critique of the ways in which, or a interrogation, perhaps, an exploration of the ways in which sometimes the Herero and Nama genocides are treated as a rehearsal for the Holocaust. Yet as one of the actors in the play, in the process of this rehearsal, notes, if it's happening to real people, you can't just call it as a rehearsal, as if all of the action is somewhere else. The real action is in Europe, and Africa is merely a staging ground, a rehearsal that's preparing techniques of genocide for the main event. There's certainly lots of similarities between what happened in Southwest Africa and Germany in terms of concentration camps, slave labor, scalping, a whole range of different kinds of things. And some of the same officers were moved from and built on their colonial expertise in Southeast Africa as functionaries in the SS back in Germany. And then certainly the land question, also you can see certain kinds of similarities between the way in which Lebens from the particular notion of appropriation of land and extension of land within Europe for the German population was also something that was constitutive in Southwest Africa. The play is a way in which to think about how we think about similarity and difference, how we think about continuities and change. And I think in that sense, it actually invites us to open the door further, not only in comparing or situating Germany and the Holocaust in relation to Southwest Africa, but to think of settler colonialism more generally. And so this is, I think, the other role of the term rehearsal, that it's also about how we think about a global history of settler colonialism, not as a singular history, not as a one world history, but as things that are happening in many places, but have a connection that, Lisa Lowe in a different context speaks about the intimacy of four continents. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about all of these different kinds of theaters of settler colonialism. And so rehearsal for me is also valuable in thinking about that. There are multiple rehearsals in different kinds of places. You know, what is the real event is unclear, but the rehearsal actually becomes then the real event for different people in different places, even though it's a backdrop for other people in other places.
I think you very usefully draw on this sort of double meaning of rehearsal, where you develop the sense in which a rehearsal is a practice brutality, in the sense that this brutality has been practiced elsewhere, yeah. and is reproduced. And that there's also a sense in which both colonial and post-colonial genocides involve a mimicry. And as we know, and your discussion of Homi Bhabha and others point out, mimicry is never the same. There's always a kind of an alteration and re-inscription that takes place in the process of rehearsal. Now, moving to the redemptive narratives of international law, that we noted at the beginning, where we say, well, international lawyers are being called on to speak about a crisis. There's a sense in which international criminal law, the laws of war, the articulations of war crimes, and then genocide as the sort of apex crime, and the Rome Statute framework for the International Criminal Court are seen as a linear redemptive narrative of international law. And part of what you and other TWEL scholars, as third world approaches to international law scholars, argue is that a critique of this redemptive narrative is necessary. Do you want to sort of expand on how you go about doing that?
Yes. Sure. So one is in terms of the linearity of the narrative. You know, if you think of it as not a singular history, but in fact multiple histories, we may resituate particular kinds of particular kinds of events and make different kinds of connections. So one, the element is, you know, a little bit of what I mentioned earlier, that thinking of international law's own complicity within this, rather than thinking of international law as standing outside of political conflict. International law is itself both constituted by conflict and has its own stakes in it. And there is some argument about whether each of these events, that's often when international law is brought in the name of doing justice, or in the name of speaking for victims. There's a real question, you know, Marty Koskinen asks this about for either International Criminal Tribunal regarding the former Yugoslavia. What's happening in The Hague, is it for the people of the Balkans, or is it really for international law, international lawyers, and those of us who are sort of a part of the logic of the tribunalization of justice, to use sort of Kamari Clark's term in some sense. And that's one element about thinking about international law as not sort of the savior from the outside, but is in fact also bearing all of these things, including particular notions of race and race making that it's then asked to adjudicate. And that's perhaps one other element of it in terms of thinking about how international, you know, when you go into the halls of the International Criminal Court, the sort of entrance hall has got this wall which says, for the cause of humanity. And the International Criminal Court claims to speak for humanity in that sense, and defines and legitimizes its own work in relation to humanity. Part of the work of TWIL scholars, I think, has been to, and certainly my own interest, is partly to interrogate that notion of the human that gets invoked and look at, in fact, the ways in which that's actually different notions of the human are internal to it. You know, it's perhaps an old Fanonian insight that then recurs in terms of how we think about colonialism, that you know, some humans are more human than others, so that certain kinds of humans can be sacrificed. And we see that, you know, this is part related to the earlier conversation we were having about genocide, but how do you make certain humans, how certain lives grievable, certain lives not, certain kinds of indifferences become normalized and certain kinds not. International law is part of that story. It's deeply implicated in that story at each of these points. It doesn't mean that international law is damned in some sense, in a way that's whether not useful, but it needs to be situated. And in some cases, we invoke international law. In some cases, we may deconstruct it. We need to be able to see it in some sense as political. To the extent that international law is sort of is translating everything into a depoliticized vernacular, that may in fact be in the interests of those who are most powerful in any broad thing, or those who want to hide in some sense the distributive stakes of something. I think our task may always to retranslate international law into the political, to look at what precisely is at stake, what are the implications of different formulations, and so on.
Again, this is a point that I think Mamdani makes in Neither Settler Nor Native. What we see in the rolling out of the American model is the production of political communities and political relations at play. And when genocide is invoked, for example, currently in the context of Palestine, there's this imagination that there can be a kind of legal response and a legal framing of what are settler colonial and other political actions and transformations at play. And it is that framing that I think critical international lawyers and TWIL scholars try to bring into the frame. Now, just finally, you obviously draw on literature in your work, and your reference to Jackie Sibley Drury's play on the Nama and Herero is one example of that, but there are others. And I know you're an avid reader of Coetzee and others. So I wondered finally whether you wanted to say something about how you use literature in processing, analyzing the kinds of events that we see unfolding right now.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, international law is really also, and perhaps all legal analysis is also partly about analysis of texts. And in that sense, I think has much profit from learning from sort of literary techniques of analysis as well. So one of the most best known post-colonial readings, you know, when Edward Said reads Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, he speaks of what he calls contrapuntal analysis, about situating all the wealth of the Bertram family in Regency England in things that are offstage. Mm-hmm. in things that are happening around plantations in Antigua, and which are mentioned in passing, but it's really, it's not something that is central to the plot, as it were. And I think that's, that, for instance, we've been talking about Nuremberg. One way in which thought about Nuremberg is in relation to the fact that the London Charter establishing Nuremberg was passed on the same week when Hiroshima and Nagasaki get bombed. Mm-hmm. And that's in some sense offstage of mm-hmm. Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. It's not what's mm-hmm. on what we're discussing with Nuremberg, but it is, of course, deeply relevant to the moral authority that's claimed with Nuremberg, what Nuremberg opens up and what it obscures in terms of the new world order that it's sort of legitimizing and flagging mm-hmm. in some sense. So in that sense, I think that's just one example, but how international law gains from opening up text and opening up international law in ways that it can borrow equally from literature. I don't think of literature as a discipline that somehow that it should be celebrated as somehow outside of its own political constraints. But for all of these, we need, in some sense, a reading of text in ways that borrow from wherever we can get insights and wherever it opens up outside of canonical readings in ways that can interrupt the dominant logics. One thing to say about international law is that, you know, James Young, who's a theorist of memorials, and has looked at the fact that, you know, Germany is, for instance, full of Holocaust memorials. And he was one of the judges trying to choose, in some sense, the memorial, the Berlin Memorial. And he speaks about this proliferation of memorials as something that is, in fact, rather than being a Germany's own accounting with its own history, it can be an evasion of memory. So I think with international law as well, that, you know, we should see all these monuments that we have, like Nuremberg, the ICC, the tribunals, as particular kinds of, that have the potential of being particular kinds of evasions, precisely in that mode, that they can, in the name of justice, they can be a way of evading justice. You know, some people may argue that in this current conjuncture, for instance, that Germany, you know, in its prohibition on critique of Israel, the limits on protests, public protests, and so on, is in fact transferring its own history of anti-Semitism onto the Palestinians. That this is another kind of evasion, where those who are responsible for the horrific history of anti-Semitism end up being brown bodies and not Europeans. These kinds of things are, I think, useful in thinking of international law, whether we are thinking about literature, whether we're thinking about art, whether we're thinking of the politics of memory, as relevant to the legal canon as the usual gods of the international legal enterprise. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Vasuki, as ever, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for your time, and especially for waking up really early so we can negotiate this transatlantic time difference. But that was a really, I think, important point you make about the need to focus on what's off stage and how literary forms really open up how we might do that. But thank you again for your wonderful work overall and for the opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.